So what I want to talk about primarily is about Hawking radiation, but I was asked to speak at this conference. Unfortunately, I don't know anything about what emergence really is. So it's hard for me to talk, but let me try and wave my hands and maybe relate it to analogy, which I think is perhaps a better concept than emergence. In analogy, you have A and B are like each other in some aspect, and there are other aspects in which they aren't like each other at all. Emergence often seems to be that a statement that if only we look at them, A and B are really the same thing, rather than that A and B are like each other. But that A is really the right way of thing as is really the right way, and B is some sort of approximation. But anyway, what I really want to do here is to look at a specific example, namely Hawking radiation and general relativity. And what I'm going to talk about primarily is analogy, in other words, equations for two different systems in a restricted set of circumstances are similar between the two physical systems. And that one can perhaps use that analogy to understand one of the systems by looking at the other. So we all know that in 1974, Stephen Hawking predicted that black holes are not black, but have a temperature proportional to 1/mass. The temperature is very small for any kind of black holes that we expect to exist in the universe, namely black holes formed by collapse of a star or something. Temperatures of the order of 10^-5 Kelvin, which is really hard to see against the background of 3 degrees Kelvin that we have out there. I'm going to demonstrate a system which is even worse, but we'll get to that. Now, one of the things that Bekenstein suggested in 1972 was that black holes had an entropy. This was in many ways a very bad analogy because what he said was, look, Hawking and Christodoulou had both argued that there's some aspect of the black hole. Hawking recognized that this was the area of the black hole, which always increased, at least if energy was positive. We know something else in physics that always increases, namely the entropy. Therefore, they must be the same thing. It's not a great argument. When he was trying to do this, he had led him to all sorts of contortions to show, for example, that the second law would be obeyed for black holes. He, in fact, had to invent new laws of physics in order to make it work. But then, after Hawking's work, one very trivially just writes down TdS equals dE. We realize that E is just the mass of the black hole from E equals mc squared. C and h bar and so forth will all be one in my units. And the temperature is inversely proportional to the mass, so we integrate that up. And we find that the entropy is exactly the area divided by 4. So this very bad analogy turned out to be actually a much better analogy than anyone had any right to expect. One of the problems with, I could go on and have a whole talk about entropy of black holes and so forth, and all of the things that have been said about that, but that's not what I want to talk about here. The problem is that derivation that Hawking made really makes very little physical sense. It's perfectly good mathematics, but it makes very little physical sense, and then we can see that by looking at, this is supposed to be a space-time diagram, with time going up, space coming out, radius coming out from a center over here. This is in the Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. And these are some light rays that come out of the black hole at light times and equally spaced over here. As we go back, those light rays can't have come from inside the black hole, so they all get squeezed up against the horizon. They get exponentially squeezed against the horizon so that if we go into the past, the frequency goes as e to the t over 4m. So if the initial frequency was, for example, sorry, if we look at the exact equations, if it goes as e to the I omega t here, it goes as t naught minus t, where t naught is the time of this last light ray that eventually escapes, to the power of I omega over 4m. If one looks, for example, at a solar mass black hole and you ask the radiation that comes out, the Hawking radiation that comes out 1 second after it forms, originated from quantum fluctuations in the initial state that have a frequency of e to the 10 to the fifth. I don't have to give you units for that because any set of units that I give you will only change that 10 to the fifth by some tiny amount. So this could be masses of the universe. It goes as the initial frequency is e to the 10 to the fifth masses of the universe. That's clearly silly. We simply don't believe the theory at the point that we're dealing with frequencies and wavelengths, wavelength just being c over that, dealing with frequencies and wavelengths of that kind of size. This theory is absolute. We know it's just completely wrong at that point. Quantum gravity effects should be absolutely dominant at that point. Now, experiments would be determinant, but unfortunately, we can't find any little black holes that we could actually measure their temperature. And as I mentioned, the temperature of a solar mass black hole is far too small to be able to see it against the 3-degree radiation. Back in 1972, I was asked to give a colloquium at Oxford. And in the course of that colloquium, I apologize to some of you who have seen this transparency too many times already. In the course of that colloquium, I wanted to describe black holes. And I said, imagine that we've got a world of fish, and these fish have ears. Those are ears, not fins. And so they experience the world only through their sense of sound. Outside the black hole, and there's this waterfall, a particularly virulent waterfall in this world, so that at some point the velocity of the water is equal to the velocity of sound in the water. Then outside, you get the sound waves just traveling out in all directions if there were a sound emitted over here. However, if you emit a sound over here, then the successive sound waves traveling out never get anywhere. They're stuck at that horizon, just as light is stuck near the horizon of a black hole. And there's this exponential peeling property for the sound waves just at the vicinity of this horizon, just as for black holes. If there's some poor graduate student who happens to have fallen over this or have been sent over the waterfall by his supervisor, and he suddenly realizes what's happening and yells for help, as he yells for help just as he's falling through, he thinks he's yelling, "Help!" And what is heard by the supervisor is, "Help!" The frequencies get base shifted out of audibility very, very rapidly as he falls through that horizon. Well, this turned out to be a better example. This turned out to be a better analogy than I had any right to expect. It turned out that, in fact, if you look at the sound waves in a flowing fluid, that they obey an equation which is exactly the same as the equation of motion of a scalar field in a background spacetime, where this effective metric is described in terms of the velocity of sound and the velocity of the fluid. And when c squared equals v squared, in other words, the velocity of the fluid is equal to the velocity of sound, this term goes to zero, and this represents the horizon. If we choose, for example, the radial velocity to be the square root of 2m over r, where r is the radial distance, then in fact this metric is exactly the Schwarzschild metric in a particular set of coordinates called the Pan-Levi-Groulstrand coordinates. So one can in fact mimic the motion of scalar fields in a background spacetime just by looking at the motion of sound waves in this flowing fluid. One can, in fact, use Hawking's argument step by step to derive that the temperature is proportional to the rate of change of the velocity at that horizon, at the point at which C equals V. So the temperature is again determined by the geometry of this background flow. If one uses the hydrodynamic approximation, which was used to derive that, this suffers from exactly the same ultra-high frequency problems that Hawking's derivation did. However, we know that there's the atomic nature of matter, which prevents ultra-high frequencies from existing. You can't have sound waves with wavelengths less than the interatomic spacing. As a result, this theory has, in a sense, a natural cutoff. One of the questions that arose was the question of whether or not this destroys the effect, or to put it another way, to ask it in a more neutral way, is what's the influence of the ultra-high frequencies on the Hawking evaporation phenomenon? Do they play a crucial role, as his derivations seem to indicate that they do, or is this just sort of an accident of the peculiar derivation that he used? It was Ted Jacobson that realized the crucial way of handling this was to look at the dispersion relationship for sound waves. The hydrodynamic approximation we know breaks down as one gets to smaller and smaller distances, and one of the key ways in which it breaks down is by altering the dispersion relation for sound waves from omega equals c times k, where k is the wave number, 2 pi divided by the wavelength, omega is 2 pi times the frequency. Instead of having omega equals ck, you get omega equals some function of k, which at long wavelengths, small values of k, is just linear, i.e. omega equals ck. What? I'm a terrible speller. I apologize for that. Any misspellings you see there are misspellings. Well, we all know about these dispersion relations. Any of us that have taken condensed matter courses have looked at the problem of a bunch of masses on springs, and we know that we can look at the modes of oscillation of this system, and we find a dispersion relationship, a relationship between the frequency and the wave number, which is just sinusoidal. So omega equals sine of k, or k over k naught. Most materials, this is sort of a bad sketch of the dispersion relationship for liquid helium. That's the roton dip. Pardon? On this side, that's the other direction. The frequency is, e to the I omega t, the frequency is negative.
So you're not plotting the energy then?
I'm plotting the frequency versus the wave number. E to the I omega t, e to the minus I omega t.
Okay.
For a real wave, you get a combination of them, etc. Of course, there's the other branch, which is the sound waves traveling in the opposite direction, which is just the reflection of this, just as this dotted line is the reflection for the waves along the coiled spring that travel in the opposite direction. The dispersion relation for liquid helium starts to get a complete mess over here because we're getting down to the point where we're looking at the interatomic spacing of the helium molecules from each other. And a mode description starts to become a rather poor description in that regime. Yeah, well, that's what that turn up and plateau, that was supposed to be my sketch of the turn up and the plateau, except the plateau is a mess. I mean, you do neutron scattering and you just get a mess at that regime because you don't really have sound waves there anymore. So I suggested that perhaps this whole thing could, back in 1980, could be used to actually run experiments. There's a question mark in this title, And that was a genuine question mark. There's a theorem that I heard from Scott Tremaine, which was basically that if ever you see a title with a question mark in it, the answer is always no. Well, this is not true of this question mark. This was a genuine question mark that I wasn't sure whether or not one could do experiments. We'll get there. You know the answer. Over the years, a whole bunch of people around the world have looked for many different kinds of systems in which one might be able to do experiments. For example, waves and various kinds of waves and fluids, electromagnetic waves and waveguides, fibers, sound waves and Bose-Einstein condensates, etc. In all of these cases, they obey the same equations as Hawking, and one gets an effective metric at low frequencies and low wave numbers. Once you get up to high frequencies and high wave numbers, however, they all obey very different equations from the ones that Hawking assumed. So the metric, when this metric appears only at low wave numbers, and one of the questions is, can one call this some sort of emergent gravity? And I'll come on to that a little bit later again. So the main question that I want to use this to answer is, does the Hawking effect really depend on that ultra-short wavelength physics? I was fortunate this year of being able to visit Niagara Falls, actually twice, and Iguazu Falls in Brazil, Argentina, on the border there. These are both the most incredible waterfalls in the world, the highest volume of water. They're very close to each other in the volume of water that flows over them. This is only a small part of the Iguazu Falls. Their falls are much thinner than the Niagara ones, but extend over a much, much larger distance. However, even these falls aren't good enough. In order to get the water in the falls to exceed the velocity of sound, one would have to have a waterfall that's of the order of 100 kilometers high, because the velocity of sound in water is over a kilometer per second. Yes?
Is laminar, right?
Yes.
The background flow. But at the velocities that you want, it's clearly going to be turbulent, right?
In which case?
In real fluid. In real.
It doesn't have to be turbulent, but in many cases it will be. And that's one of the experimental difficulties that one has to try and overcome. Yes.
Okay.
Bose-Einstein condensates, for example, is hard to produce turbulence. Yeah, you can nucleate vortices, but it's hard. I mean, anyway, let's not waste time on that. For the surface waves in water, the dispersion relationship, instead of going as omega squared is proportional to k, which is what happens at low wave numbers. So at low wave numbers, the velocity of these waves, both the group and the phase velocity, just goes as the square root of g times the depth of the water, where h is the depth of the water. At high wave numbers, where k times h is bigger than 1, this simply becomes unity. And at that point, the phase velocity goes as the square root of g divided by k, and the group velocity is, actually that should be a 4. G divided, so the group velocity is 1/2 the phase velocity. So one gets dispersion at high wave numbers, and that's going to be important. Now, one of the things I have to emphasize, this is a question that keeps coming up. I'm suggesting doing experiments with water. Water is a classical substance. It's not, of course, it's a quantum substance, just like everything else in the world is. But let's say we know what we mean, that this, when we're looking at this water, it's a classical system. How in the world can I talk about the Hawking effect, which is a quantum effect, with this classical system? Well, one of the really neat things about quantum mechanics, especially for any kind of a linear quantum system, is one where you feed in an input and the output is linearly proportional to the input, is that the quantum behavior is completely determined by the classical behavior. In particular, there's this concept of a norm, which is conserved, which is just the momentum, configuration variable star times the moment, conjugate momentum summed over all of the aspects of the system that one happens to be looking at. So if this is a quantum field theory, this would be the momentum of the quantum field times the configuration variable integrated over all points in space. This quantity is a conserved quantity. It turns out that in going from the classical theory to the quantum theory, what's important is to look at the difference between the positive and the negative norm solutions. Because of that not minus sign there, this is not a positive definite norm. The complex conjugate of a solution has the opposite norm of the solution itself, for example. It turns out that this is the thing that's absolutely crucial to the quantization of the system. And the positive norm things are the things that correspond to the things that we usually label annihilation operators, and the negative norm are the things that correspond to the creation operators. Not positive and negative frequencies, that so many of you have been taught in your quantum field theory classes. It's positive and negative norms that are important. And the particle creation rate is determined by the classical negative norm output. If you put in a positive norm wave and you get some negative norm wave coming out, that immediately indicates that in the quantum regime you're going to get quantum particles created. Now, these factors, the negative norm output and the positive norm output, B and A, are completely determined classically. Okay. Are completely determined classically by just running this amplifier, running classical inputs into the system, and seeing how much they're amplified. This is, for example, for these surface waves, this is, for example, the dispersion relation in the flowing water, where the water is flowing more slowly than the velocity of sound. The dispersion relationship looks like this. This is the square root of k part of that dispersion relationship in still water, which gets distorted due to the flow of the water. We notice that at a given frequency, there are three possible solutions here. These two are both positive norm, and this one's a negative norm. Notice that the negative norm solution also has negative phase velocity. Omega, which is positive, divided by k, which is negative, is negative. These guys have positive phase velocity. This is a low-frequency wave. Its group velocity is in towards this region where the horizon forms. This one has a group velocity that goes away. This one has a group velocity that goes towards. So these are the two input channels, and these are the two output channels. By sending in classical, ordinary waves, for example, here, and measuring the intensity of these two guys, one can determine what the quantum output of this system is going to be. Well, this is all very well, and we're going to hear much more about the experiment that we actually did from Silke in the next talk. One can also ask, as many people have had, well, if this metric is sort of an emergent property of the flow of fluids, maybe all of gravity is just an emergent property of some condensed matter system. I.e., are we going to go back to the 19th century and postulate that there's an ether and that the fluctuations and the properties of this ether are perhaps the various fields in physics, which was the big program at the end of the 19th century, to show how everything in physics could be described by, for example, vortices and knots and so forth within the ether. One of the big problems is we know systems like this. For example, if we look at the sound waves in the Earth caused by earthquakes, You have the P waves, which is what hits you first in an earthquake. These are the pressure waves inside the earth. You have the shear waves, which hit you later and shake you back and forth and up and down on the surface. You also have surface waves, Rayleigh surface waves, etc. Could one imagine that these are all just different fields in nature? People have suggested it, for example, Zhang, that if one looks at surface states in a quantum Hall effect, there maybe we can describe a metric, and maybe that metric even obeys Einstein's equations. The argument there is pretty weak. Harava has come up with similar kinds of dispersive models, and Silke will be talking a little bit about this in her talk. One of the problems is all of these models have a special time, and they're Newtonian in that sense. And one of the things we know about earthquakes is that the P waves and the S waves travel at very different velocities. And this seems to be a fairly generic feature of theories with a special time in them. And so one of the problems is the universality of C. In our world, all fields have the same limiting velocity, which is usually called the velocity of light in vacuum. Of course, recently there have been these experiments where people have suggested that that's not true, that neutrinos travel slightly faster. I don't believe it. But anyway, you know, just to be completely honest here, maybe there's more to this than meets the eye. Emergent theories tend to have different velocities, limiting velocities for all of the fields and different dispersion relation, unless you have a lot of fine-tuning in the theory. So emergence, A is the same as B, can be very problematic. A and B are different, are almost always very different theories, so either you have to neglect some of the aspects of either A or B, or assume that one or the other of them are the real thing and the other one is just an approximation. But I think a lot of that is just a distraction and causes us to concentrate on the differences. If we think about them as analogies, those analogies can be immensely powerful, even though we know that A and B are very different theories. So perhaps one would like to think of physics as a pun. I always start my course in the physics of music by telling the students what physics is like, and I tell them that physics is like this old vaudeville joke, why is a steamship like an elephant? And we, of course, all know the answer. They both carry trunks. And I get about the same amount of laughter out of my students. So perhaps what we should be doing is thinking of physics as this same kind of pun. Why is H2O like argon? Because they both carry Navier-Stokes as a collective description. That's probably an even worse joke, and one that only a physicist might be able to appreciate. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for just a few questions, but there'll be, of course, discussion possible after the break. Leo?
I don't understand what the word norm means. My math books tell me norms are positive.
Your math book tells you norms are positive. This is a particular case in which one has a negative norm. For example, the length of a vector in special or general relativity can be either positive or negative, one of them indicating time-like vectors, one indicating space-like vectors. So we're all familiar with situations in which one has norms with both signs. This one is slightly peculiar in that there are an equal number of positive norm as negative norm solutions. So it's not that you only have some subset like the time-like vectors. Here, all of them are both positive, you know, are all, you get both an equal number of both. This can cause some trouble, but in fact, it turns out to be the whole basis of the annihilation and creation operators, and it's what leads to the commutation relationships between the annihilation and the creation operators is that switch in sign. So if you try and so the annihilation operators are associated with one, the creation operators are associated with one, the other. When you take that commutation relation between them, what you find is that that's just equal to the norm of the two solutions that correspond to those annihilation and creation operators. And it's that flip in sign that corresponds to the fact that if you take the opposite commutation relation, you get the minus sign. A dagger is equal to plus one, A dagger A is equal to minus one. And that comes about because of that norm.
There was one part.
It's conserved. The important thing about it is it's a conserved quantity for any linear system. No matter what the Hamiltonian is, it can be a horribly time-dependent Hamiltonian, it's still, that norm is still conserved.
Something I didn't follow in your talk, you point out that if you do an experiment on different fluids, or if you do the theory for it, then the way these fluids look like at high energy is different. So helium might be totally different from water. And you mentioned at one point that somehow you're going to show that even though in the Hawking derivation the result is dominated by high incoming frequencies, this problem went away with fluids. So, but I didn't follow why and how it went away.
That's because I didn't say it. That's why you didn't follow it. I mean, the first thing is that these theories have cutoffs, and so those cutoffs immediately lead to the fact that you can't have arbitrarily high wave numbers or arbitrarily high frequencies. So, you know, from that point, that was in a sense the main point of the argument. If you look at them in more detail, what you find is the behavior, if you go back from the future and head towards the horizon, the thing starts getting squeezed against the horizon, then its group velocity suddenly drops. At that point, it can't stick near the horizon. It has to have come from outside and been dragged into the horizon. Once it's outside the horizon, it's no longer squeezed, so you no longer get this arbitrarily high squeezing. You only get a finite amount of squeezing, which takes place while the wave packet squeezes against the horizon until its group velocity changes. At that point, it no longer gets squeezed against the horizon, and one gets a finite frequency and wave number for the incoming radiation that caused the thermal radiation at the output. Despite this great change, this tremendous change in the dispersion relationship and in the behavior of these waves and wave packets, you find that the thermal numerical simulations show you that this thing still produces thermal radiation with a very constant temperature over a very wide range of frequencies and wave numbers.
So you're saying that you can show that you get the same Hawking temperature even if you're using fluids with totally different dispersion relations.
Right.
So what's wrong with Hawking's derivation then?
Well, I mean, what's wrong with Hawking's derivation is that it has these arbitrarily high things in there. I think the question you're trying to ask, is there a derivation that one could make which showed that it was obviously insensitive to what's going on at those high frequencies? And that's one of the big things that nobody really knows how to do yet. You can sort of hand wave your way around it, but nobody has a really good derivation which demonstrates that the thermal radiation coming out is insensitive to what's going on at high frequencies. It's not utterly insensitive that dispersion relation does change the temperature very slightly, so that's part of what makes it hard to prove that it's insensitive, because it's not entirely insensitive, it's just almost entirely insensitive. So nobody really has a good derivation that doesn't make use of these, in the black hole case, of the ultra-high frequencies. There are ways of doing it. You talk about analyticity, but as we know, analyticity is extremely dangerous. The function e to the minus alpha x is vanishingly small for all reasonable values of x, but if I let alpha go to if I let x go to ix, then I get a thing that's arbitrarily large. So analyticity also makes strong assumptions about the behavior of what's going on at high frequencies.
Okay, unless there's a really quick question and, I guess more importantly, a really quick answer. okay, Ted.
This doesn't sound like it's going to be either.
Just to go on record, I don't agree that there's no derivation that avoids the high frequencies.
Okay, I think that's the answer. And so let's take the coffee break, which I guess is downstairs, and then we'll resume here in really not much more than about 15 minutes. So drink your coffee quickly.